Blog Talk Radio.
And you're in the G-Zone with Giovanni Gelati. Gio, what's going on today?
Thank you, Big Daddy. Well, today we have the George Taylor's podcast. Today he's going to be featuring Sue Badeau. She is the author of a number of titles, so George will go into that in his podcast here. I don't want to steal any of his thunder. If you go to the Helping Hands Press store, any of Sue's books are on sale right now, as well as the other authors and Helping Hands Press. If you go to the Helping Hands Press store, you can get 25% off audiobooks, ebooks, paperbacks right now. Simply use the code SPRINGSUPERSALE at checkout. And without further ado, here is George Taylor. On the other side of this, we're going to play the audiobook from the newly released Voice of Ada Stayman by Tony Helling. And then we'll have an interview with Kurt and Sandra Lovelace. So here's George.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. We're on podcast number 14 today, and I've got a really special episode on tap. Sue Badeau, author, speaker, husband to Hector, and together the parents to 22 children. Yeah, you heard it right, 22, and they've also been foster parents to over 50 children. She was in Atlanta recently, and I took the opportunity to go down to Atlanta and spend some time with her. She graciously agreed to be interviewed for this podcast. Sue is the author of a number of books, as well as a speaker on topics related to children. She and her husband have won numerous awards for their work, including being recognized by President Clinton with an Adoption Excellence Award and receiving an Angels in Adoption Award from Congress. Both of these awards were for their work on behalf of adoption and children in foster care. She'll tell us some of her story today on this podcast, but you can find out more by visiting her website. It's SueBadeau.com, and that's SueBadeau.com. So let's let Sue tell some of her story.
So I'm sitting here with Sue Badeau. We're sitting outside of Atlanta in Peachtree City, Georgia. Sue Badeau's down here for a conference she's teaching at, and I decided to come down and meet her and talk with her, and she's got some interesting stories to tell. I wanted to share some of those stories with you, and I'm going to start out, just tell us just a little bit about you and your journey, Sue.
Okay, well, it's great to be with you, and we've had a nice time here in Peachtree City.
We have.
So I grew up in Barre, Vermont, a small town in Vermont, and dated my high school sweetheart, and we ended up, after college, getting married. But while we were still in high school, even, we talked about someday maybe wanting to adopt children and thinking about what that would mean, what that would look like. We thought, well, let's have two and adopt two. That seemed like a good game plan. We went on. We did get married. We did start that process. We had two children born to us. We did adopt two. But we went a little deeper into it after that. we met some kids in foster care. We had some emergency foster care placements in our family. We learned about what happens to adults who never really get attached to a family during their childhood, and we really wanted to make a difference, and so we started getting more involved with foster care, and over the years adopting a few more of those kids.
Well, you told me you have adopted about 10 more than those two that you, or 10 times more
10
than
times.
Those,
right, right.
Those two that you started with.
That's
so you
right.
have 20 adopted children,
That's
plus
right.
your own two, plus countless numbers that you have influenced
yes,
through the years.
Exactly. We've fostered, we've informally cared for, we've mentored, we've had a variety of different roles with
wow.
many, many kids.
That's a phenomenal imprint on our society. Thank you.
We've certainly gained a lot from it.
Yeah, I know you have. I know you have. You are also an author. You're a speaker. Who do you generally talk to? Who are you contracted to talk with?
So I do probably three different types of audiences.
Mm-hmm.
One would be agencies that work with children in foster care or
okay.
adoption, and so they'll hire me to come do trainings for their staff or to speak at events that they have. Sometimes it's mixed audience of social work staff and legal staff, like judges, lawyers that work in these systems, community people, teachers. Mm-hmm. So it's, but it, those are that professional kind of people mm-hmm. associated with the field. Then I also do a lot directly with families. So mm-hmm. I'll get here, for example, in Peachtree City, I'm doing speaking at a conference that's intended for parents, foster parents, adoptive parents. They have this every year, and it's a great opportunity for the families to get time together, to get support from one another, and get some training and teaching in mm-hmm. areas that are mm-hmm. beneficial to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the third audience, sometimes I get invited to speak at different services or retreats or things with churches. So
okay.
Those
okay.
would be the three different, right. and sort of in that descending order of the numbers. Of
okay. All right. I understand. So are you speaking from an educational background? Are you educated in this other than obviously your life experience? Where is your formal training?
Right. So my college degree was in child development.
Okay.
And I focused particularly on children in special education. Mm-hmm. So that was my major when
okay.
I was in college.
Okay.
So that's my initial educational background. And then although I didn't actually obtain over the years a master's, I went into master's level work in social services, child psychology, some of those areas as well. And for a period of time, for a period of 10 years, I served on the National Child Traumatic Stress Network,
okay.
which is an organization that has a lot of the researchers and clinicians that really do brain science.
Okay.
And my role with them, a lot, I learned tremendously. I mean, that's where I got a lot of my knowledge. But also my role was to then sort of, I call it, become a translator, to take a lot of that science and put it in terms that a layperson, a regular foster parent like myself or adoptive
okay.
parent
okay.
could understand.
Okay, okay.
And actually implement and do something
all right.
with.
All right. So between the training you have and the life experience you have, you really can be, we can really call you Dr. Sue Doe, can't we?
I think I've earned it.
I think you have too.
Not to mention that I think I've earned however many high school diplomas helping all my kids get through high school.
As authors Sue and Hector append an autobiographical telling of their adventures in raising 22 children, it's appropriately entitled, Are We There Yet? You can find it at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Sue has also written devotional books and is an author for Helping Hands Press. For HHP, she has helped to write a series called Summer in Sweetland. She talks about this series and why she's excited about it.
So you also write.
Yes.
Okay. And I have recorded two books for you, but you've written far beyond that. The first book that I wanted to talk about is the Summer in Sweetland, Never Too Old,
yes.
first. Okay. So tell us about the Sweetland series, because I know you've had influence in it from before that.
Well, actually, Summer in Sweetland was the first
okay.
in the series. But, yes, a group of us were invited by Helping Hands Press to participate in this series that was going to be a number of short fictional mm-hmm. Pieces that all took place in the same small town. And so there were eight of us authors, and we got together to sort of create the town.
Mm-hmm.
So from a map of where the roads would be to the names of the local businesses or churches. But we each wrote our own story with our own cast of characters. We
okay.
shared a few characters. We kept in contact with each other so there would be a flow to it. So the whole series, that first one, Summer in Sweetland, eight stories, is very fun and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They're all distinct stories, but they're interconnected. And mine, I had a real passion to write a story that would include the themes about older children in foster care who
okay.
still need a family, often want a family, and often get overlooked when people are thinking, they think, oh, you're getting old enough, you're just going to be an adult, why do you still need a family?
Mm-hmm.
So that's my theme, you're never too old to need a family.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
And yet it's fiction, so there's other things. There's a plot line, of course. There's activities that happen. There's characters that get developed. There's a whole family, the Evers family, that's an adoptive family, and then there's girls in a group home that are part of the town, part of the community of Sweetland, and there's, you know, little crises in their
mm-hmm.
lives and things
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a lot of fun to write and to be part of. And that particular book did, when it was released, became Amazon one of their bestsellers in that category
okay.
right away. So
right.
that was also exciting. And then Helping Hands liked the outcome of that whole Sweetland series so much they produced a sequel at Christmas time called 'Tis the Season in Sweetland, and then a third sequel at just this recent Easter time called Sunrise in Sweetland.
Mm-hmm.
And so the same group of authors with a couple of variations, again, did those stories mm-hmm. at Christmas time and at Easter. And so we followed the same characters, went deeper into their lives and developing them, added, of course, some new ones here and there. They had some new adventures and crises and things like that. My story in the Christmas season one of the children in the family was a teenage boy that had been in the juvenile justice system mm-hmm. and then had recently, right before Christmas, gotten out. And so that story kind of focuses on him and one of his buddies
mm-hmm.
and their experience reintegrating back into the community.
Okay.
But what happened that was especially fun, and that, you know, I think because you've also recorded a book for another author that's part of the Sweetland series, Peg Glenn Pfeiffer, she got interested in the characters that I initially developed in my Summer in Sweetland series from the group home.
Right.
And she liked them so much that she wanted to include them in her next story and help them to get adopted.
Right.
So she did, and as part of that, we communicated regularly, and we had never met, but we've become really close friends, and
mm-hmm.
You know, she would ask me the questions about how long would an adoption take, or so her stories are very authentic about the process because she really did do her homework on that. And not only then did she carry those characters into the next Sweetland sequel, but she's now got her own series that she's launching, and just the first one recently came out, and totally taking following the lives of these young girls now as they become young adults and as they move into their adult years.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it's just very exciting. I feel like I sort of feel like the grandmother of these children watching them flourish and grow. And it's been very exciting to see it have life. And especially because I really think people need to know more about kids that are in foster care and kids that need families and need mentors and need support in the community. And not everyone comes to a conference like the one mm-hmm. I'm at. If you're not already in it. But you might read fiction.
Right.
You might pick up mm-hmm. a collection of fiction, mm-hmm. and then you might read it and say, oh, this might be something I'd like to learn more about. And that's what excites me about these fictional stories, mine and the other Sweetlanders
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
Peg. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Well, that's one of the things I've been talking about over the last couple of weeks when I've talked about historical fiction. We may not necessarily read history, but when we read these books based in history and steeped in history, then we learn about our history as a result.
Absolutely. And what I love about historical fiction is it helps you understand the daily lives of people.
Right.
From, you know, you may have learned something about history, hopefully, in school. Mm-hmm. We all learned something. But it's often timelines, dates, wars, presidents.
Right.
You know,
and this is about people.
People and their lives.
Yeah.
And that's what's so rich.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
Exactly.
I asked Sue what was her favorite passage from the Sweetland series book that she authored, Never Too Old, and she told me this.
Out of Never Too Old, I love how it culminates towards the end, of course, but I think my favorite part of it is there's a court hearing that's
mm-hmm.
happening, and one of the main characters, the mother, is a social worker, so she has
mm-hmm.
to go to court on one of her cases. But while she's there, she runs into one of the girls from the group home who's having a hearing about her own life, and they slip notes back and forth to each
mm-hmm.
other.
It had been 45 minutes since the lunch break, and Celia was still waiting for her four cases to be called. Court days were so frustrating. Hurry up and wait, as they say. The door to the waiting room opened, and Wendy stepped in with a young woman who must have been her caseworker. She shyly waved to Celia and took a seat, pulling a book from her backpack. Celia scooted closer to Wendy and asked how school was going. It's okay. I'm having a little trouble with a few classes, but it'll work out. I see you're reading the Epic of Sanjara. That's a powerful story. Wendy's eyes lit up. Really? You know it? I love ancient stories. I guess that makes me odd, but I see so many parallels with my own life. It's fascinating that a story told so long ago could help me understand my life better than most of the people who know me. I mean, the way Sanjara had to move around so much after being exiled, it's a lot like life in foster care. I'm thinking of majoring in African studies if I get to go to college, but people tell me I wouldn't be able to use that degree for any real-world jobs. Wendy sighed as the door opened and the court clerk ushered another caseworker with three children into the courtroom. Wendy wrote a note and passed it to Celia. "Is it true that teenagers like me can be adopted? My caseworker says I'm too old. She wants me to sign up for a supervised independence program and get an apartment, but I'm not so sure I'm ready for that." Hastily, Celia scribbled on the back of the note and passed it back to Wendy. "Never too old. Tell the judge you want a family. He'll listen." After Celia's cases were completed, Wendy's case was called. Celia gave the girl a smile she hoped was encouraging and whispered a quick prayer that the judge would listen to this sweet girl's heart and desire for a family. "Please, Lord, I know you want Wendy to have a family of her own, a family for a lifetime. Open the doors for her today. Let her see that, unlike Sanjara, she has not been exiled. You have a place and a family for her." From her own series, Roots and Wings at Loonstone Lake, I've recorded the opening book, Call of the Loons. I asked her about that book as well.
So tell us about the other book, or Roots and Wings.
So Roots and Wings, I got interested in developing a story that, again, we have some of these themes about children who, mm-hmm. you know, are in difficult situations, whether it's foster care, adoption, juvenile justice. But I wanted to set it in an area that I was familiar with growing up in New England. I was an avid camper growing up, and my husband and I have taken our kids camping a lot and always dreamed of owning a campground someday. So we haven't actually owned
so this
one.
So this is kind of a personal dream.
I'm making the dream come true by writing about a family that owns a campground.
Your virtual dream.
That's right.
There you go.
So I wanted to set it there. I wanted to incorporate the values and the history of that part of the country, and I wanted to put a little mystery in it, because when it comes to reading, I love to read mysteries, and so I wanted to try my hand at that, and so I'm still working on it. It's about half, the whole series is about half done now, and I think the other half will be finished in the next couple of months.
That's cool.
Yeah, so that's been fun.
That's very neat. So out of Roots and Wings, pick a passage that is a favorite of yours.
I think that really it's when there's a time at near the end of the first book when the family decides, they've discovered that this campground that was in their family history mm-hmm. is now, they're going to have the opportunity to run it, but it's been closed for many years.
Right.
And they go up to decide that they are going to open it, and they get a whole bunch of volunteers from the youth group mm-hmm. and from their friends mm-hmm. and to do the whole cleanup on the area. And there's a couple of particular conversations that happen between the family members and some of the youth that are involved with the cleanup that were some of my favorite parts of that book.
Okay.
Where, you know, the youth who hadn't had this chance to feel important. One kid in particular says, well, I'm, you know, people were signing up for tests. They were going to do, I'm not good at anything.
Out.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, a kid, there's nothing I can do.
Yeah.
And then he really gets nurtured along. Mm-hmm. And so that's my favorite part, because it really, it shows the power, really, mm-hmm. of community
mm-hmm.
and of relationships
mm-hmm.
and what difference that can make in the life of a child, but also in achieving a dream. So,
okay. All right.
Luann watched, her mouth agape, as people, coolers, cleaning supplies, and cans of paint spilled out of all vehicles, and the parking area began buzzing with reunions and introductions. She and Frank walked around greeting each person, thanking them for coming to the special Loon's Nest cleanup weekend, and welcoming the newcomers as they arrived. By the time Luke, Sid, and Liam pulled in a few minutes later, six different groups of volunteers were ready to get to work. Emily pulled out her camp whistle and called the crowd to order. With all of her experience during college and in her current job organizing volunteer crews for service projects, she was the perfect person to whip this group into shape. "We have four primary projects," she began. "Yard work, painting, interior cleaning, and minor repairs. Big repairs, plumbing and such, were completed last week, so all the big systems are in tip-top shape, and you'll see we have a brand-new up-to-code kitchen in the dining hall across the road. After the interior cleaning is finished, we'll have a fifth project, bed-making and pillow-fluffing." That drew a laugh. "Each project has a crew leader," she continued. I'll introduce you to the leaders, and then, depending upon which project you are most interested in, you gather with the crew leader, and that's where you'll get further instructions and necessary supplies. Rick Ellison from Danville is in charge of the yard crew. If you want to do yard work, meet him in front of the shed over there. Don't let Robbie get in that line, Luke called out, ribbing his younger brother. He's dangerous around lawnmowers. Remember the time he cut his toe off? This drew gasps and another round of laughter before Emily could continue. Dean Withers and Damon Abernathy from Sigma Pi Phi are co-leading the painting crew. There will be both inside and outside painting jobs. Meet them by the white tent over there if you want to paint, Emily said, and continued until all leaders had been introduced and everyone had dispersed to their chosen crew. Looking up from her checklist, she noticed an overweight teenager leaning against a tree alone. I'm Emily. What's your name? She asked, walking up to him.
Kevin,
he mumbled.
Can't find a crew that interests you? I came with my youth group because the pastor said I should come. But I ain't no good at any of this stuff. I'm in foster care, so I ain't allowed to use the lawnmowers, and if I paint, I'd just make a mess.
Forget about the mess part. Is painting something you'd like to do? Emily asked and watched the boy's eyes light up just a bit as he slowly nodded.
Super. I know there's a paint job you can do. We need the whole back side of the dining hall painted. I need someone big and strong like you to work on that. Would you be willing to give it a try? I'll make sure you have a couple of helpers. You won't be alone.
Really? You gonna trust me with a paintbrush?
I sure will. Ready to start? Let's walk over so you can meet Dean and Damont, and they'll get you set up.
After Emily made sure Dean welcomed Kevin, she strolled over to where her mother and Luke were setting up a refreshment tent and getting the charcoal grill started.
Mom, I have to tell you about this boy Kevin I just met. He's exactly the kind of kid Dad wants to bring here to Loon's Nest. The campground isn't even open yet, and Dad's dream is already starting to come true. It gave me goosebumps.
Our God is a God of goosebumps and muscle grease, Luann said, looking around. Just look at all these people who showed up to help. I can hardly take it in. I do hope I planned enough food. That's author Sue Badeau. We talked about a lot of books in this interview. You heard about the Sweetland series, Summer in Sweetland, available in book as well as e-book. The segment entitled Never Too Old is also an audiobook. Both are from Helping Hands Press. Roots and Wings at Loonstone Lake is available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. The audiobook Call of the Loons can be found at Helping Hands Press. Christmas is Past, the Christmas Primer, is available at Amazon. Check the podcast description on my website, narrationbygeorge.com. Click on Podcasts, and you'll find links to all the books. Go to narrationbygeorge.com. Click on the podcast link on the menu at the top of the page. Well, that's all our time for today for the Narration by George podcast, the podcast of audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. Hope you've enjoyed our visit with Sue Badeau. I certainly did. Thank you, Sue, for spending Saturday afternoon with my wife and me. We certainly enjoyed being with you. Next week's podcast is a look forward to the Hear Now Festival in Kansas City, Missouri. I'm going to be appearing there the night of June 11th at 5:30 p.m. that's Central Time at Prospero's Books to do a live reading from Huckleberry Finn. We'll talk more about that next week. See you then next week when the Narration by George podcast will be new on Wednesday.
Oh, sorry about that. I had myself muted again. Thanks a lot, George. Looking forward to that podcast next week because I know it's pretty important to this event, which is really cool. What I want to do real quick before we bring in Kurt and Sandra Lovelace, I'm going to play the new release from Tony Hilling, the voice of Ed Stamen. I'm going to play the sample for it. The voice actor is George Taylor from Narration by George. On the other side of this, we'll bring in Kurt and Sandra Lovelace.
Helping Hands Press, Narration by George, and author Tony Hilling present The Voice of Ada Stamen, Volume 1, The Child's Arrival. If you could ask God one question, what would it be? About evil or suffering? Tony Hilling brings us an epic biblical fantasy called The Voice of Ada Stamen. Meet the chosen people who endure much evil and suffering. But there's more. Their God has a mind to save them. Seven arcs later, while much of the city of Deverinspay continued to revel in the 10-arc celebration at the palace for the birth of the king's son, two women were seen drawing near the temple of Verin in the quiet of the late evening. The sole guard at the temple was earning some extra silver, discharging his duty as the late guard of a virtually deserted temple and almost dying of boredom in the process. He was suddenly jolted from his vacant reverie by the approach of the two women. One was tall, of stately bearing, the royal purple veil partially revealing strands of her flaxen hair. The other was a dark and plainly dressed Ma'apon woman, clearly the first woman's servant. The guard snapped to attention, bringing his 5-4-arm halberd to his chest to permit entry to the temple. He risked a quick glance and recognized the king's young niece. Both women entered the temple, the Lady Kara ignoring him, her servant looking away from him anxiously. Once inside and beyond the reach of the guard's eyes and ears, the servant held out a restraining hand to her mistress.
"My lady, I am so sick with fear. To enter this place is worse than passing through the gates of death, and someone is certain to notice us."
Kara turned to her. "Do not worry, Mevedine," she whispered. "I have planned it this way. Because of the feasting, there are few people about. But Alameda will be here, because it is not yet widely known that she is the mother of the royal child.
But what about the guard?"
"I will deal with him. But listen to me. This will be difficult for you. You must steel yourself. Alameda will not be easily persuaded to release your son. You may see blood tonight. Focus on your son, and remember that whatever happens, it is necessary to get him back." Medvedine nodded, fearful. They proceeded to the inner temple and climbed the stairs that led behind the high altar of Varun, the god of the Davarang people. As she mounted the stairs beside her mistress, Medvedine looked to her right and saw with horror the pyramid of 10 rising steps leading to the platform behind the huge bowl-shaped altar of sacrifice that had consumed so many of her people's infants. And behind the altar and overarching was the massive idol of Varun, a dragon's face, bearing a fierce demoniacal grin. She also noticed, about 4 forearms above the altar, a large metal funnel connected to a wide flue that led ever upwards, directing the sacrificial vapors into the heavens. Despite this, the stench of the heat and stale, burnt human flesh was nauseating. When they approached the anteroom behind the high altar, she saw her mistress pull something out of her tunic and cover it with her outer robe on her right hand. With her left hand, she knocked on the door, then reached out and took a piece of parchment from Medvedine. A Ma'apon woman answered, looking respectfully but slyly at Kara, and seemed to look right through Medvedine.
"I wish a private conference with Lady Alameda. I will see if she can attend on you, my lady," said Jadine. "Lady Alameda will see you now."
Kara swallowed, raising her left hand to Mevedine, signaling her to stay, and went inside the anteroom. In spite of her youthful courage, Kara quaked slightly as she looked at Alameda, the legendary high priestess of the Temple of Verin. Kara knew that the royal family even feared this former temple prostitute, now sorceress and black witch. She was the sole ruler of the temple and had subtle but strong influence in the royal courts. Kara had also heard the rumor that she was consorting with the king himself.
"Why, my lady, it has been some time since I have seen you come to Varun's chambers," said Alameda, a cold, mirthless smile playing at her lips. "I no longer worship your god, Lady Alameda,"
said Kara simply. Have we gone over to the god of the defeated, of the chosen ones, or is it the conquered ones? She chuckled nastily, then turned her full glare on the young woman who stood before her. How can we help you? Kara met those dead gray eyes with a blank stare of her own. I would speak with you alone, she said. The High Priestess paused an instant and then made a side movement of her head to Jadeen. My lady? Go, said Alameda emphatically. Her attendant left and returned to her room. Now, my lady, said Alameda, the smile gone. Kara began. You have seized a boy-child for sacrifice tomorrow. He has the name Banawan tattooed on his heel. Yes, said the High Priestess. Kara knew she was expecting more. I will buy him back. What is your price? But, my lady, the king's edict was quite specific. All male children born to the Ma'apon slaves in the last 10 arcs are to be sacrificed to our god in celebration for the birth of the king's son. I cannot accede to your request without further order.
The Voice of Ada Stamen by Tony Hilling. Reviewers say, we have murder, conspiracy, bribery, deceit, abuse of power. We have one race dominating the other and treating them as slaves. All this packed into a 33-page short introductory volume, and it really does set the atmosphere very well. Hilling has one great imagination. He also writes well. It's available from Helping Hands Press and narration by George. Your narrator is George Taylor for Tony Hilling's The Voice of Ada Stamen.
All right, to the G-Zone. Today we had George Taylor on. He was interviewing Suba Doe. That was a little bit earlier in the show. Right now we have Kurt and Sandra Lovelace. How are you guys doing?
We're all right. How are you this morning?
Oh, you don't want to hear me complain too much. It's a Friday morning. Okay. I'm a little out of it. You guys have a very interesting ministry going on here, and you have some work that runs parallel with it. Can you tell folks about your book and what you guys do?
Okay. Well, they're in fact related. We were in pastorate for over 30 years and along with that made trips to Europe and other parts of the world as well, teaching people about education, about Christian family life, etc. And this book came out of the pastoral ministry, talking to people over the years about having their families together in the congregation during the time of worship.
That's pretty interesting. How is it that you dovetail all this together? Does the book run hand in hand with what you do? Your ministry came first, and then the book.
Well, actually, the content or the background and research for the book was first because we raised our own kids by having them with us in church from the very beginning, and then it fit in with the congregations that we served over the years. And a lot of our work has been serving homeschool families, people who choose to disciple their children in the academic realm. And we found that a lot of those families weren't even thinking into Sunday morning. So even though they would be providing all the different educational aspects for their children all week long, when they would get to church on Sunday, they put their children into a class. And so I guess in that way they come together, the full responsibility of parents to their children. And some people still think that it's more important or more maybe efficient to set that aside. But we think parents are the primary teachers for their children to show how to worship God.
I can go with a lot of that, but what you just said opens about 100 questions in my mind. Now I'm Catholic. When usually around this time of year, between now, like the end of June, They make announcements that there's shifts in the where the different priests serve. When you say you've worked with different congregations, how does that work for non-Catholic type thing? Do you is it an application process? Do you do people learn from others? Maybe the hook of your ministry, and they want you at their church. How does that go?
Well, that's a good question, and I wish I knew a specific answer. It's well, because we have a website these days, but it's word of mouth primarily, and it's not just Protestants. You know, we have last time we had a conference in the Netherlands. We were hosted by a Catholic family, and they were a big part of the conference as well, and they talk to other people, and as I said, word of mouth is a lot of what does this. We do a lot of follow-up. My wife primarily does a lot of follow-up with people, whether they're in country with them or wherever we may be, on telephone, on Skype, on email. And then you know, she also ends up talking with their friends, et cetera. So there are a variety of ways.
Interesting. Now, with homeschoolers or just folks that they don't have to be homeschoolers, but maybe folks that feel they don't need to be within the confines of a church per se, and they're doing their worship at home on whatever night or during the week and on Sundays. How do you help them with that? Is it something done via Skype or online? How do you do that?
We do have a lot of different avenues to encourage folks. We don't have to be there in person. Matter of fact, we do Skype visits on a regular basis in from other countries. I just did one with Norway this week. And email, there's a lot of email going back and forth. Having children with their parents throughout the corporate service is not particularly a model that people are familiar with in the last, I don't know, 50 years maybe. And so it is an issue to help them get over that hurdle. What do I say? How do I do it? And sometimes there's opposition to having children there because they're not always perfectly silent and never moving. So it's really a two-sided almost educational process, talking to parents to help them explain what they're doing, for pastors to understand what the eventual example will be, what goal is. That's one of the things. One of the stories we tell is about when Kurt was in seminary and we were approached by an assistant pastor, and he said, you know, your daughter's too cute. She's distracting people in the congregation. And so Kurt explained to him what our goals are, how we plan to reach them, and so on. We were well received after that, but it was helpful to explain.
Interesting. Now, how does the book that you have up on Amazon work within all this? Is this a framework? Is this helping to understand your ministry? How does that work with what you do?
Well, it's a pretty full-orbed approach. We start off with the biblical background, explaining that you know, most of the time we see worshipers in the Bible, both Old and New Testaments, we do see children with them. And of course, there's a statement of Jesus, suffer the little children to come to me. But we don't revolve the whole thing around that. But that it was the norm. It was just a given that that these families were together. And then we have a lot of anecdotes in there about what the one that Sandra just told you, plus a lot of things that other people have been through that we've helped them with or that we've seen. And then there is a lot of practical tips, a lot of advice, things like having a church bag, things like beginning to prepare on Saturday night for Sunday morning, things like that.
So it's biblical and practical.
Okay. Now, does this include a nice menu for the children to keep them quiet, perhaps Cheerios or something like that, or maybe a teaspoon of Benadryl before they're going to church? Is anything like that in your book?
Well, we're not medical professionals, so the Benadryl is out, but yes, there are a lot of examples like that. There's a lot of strategies. Another thing is that it's helpful to think through the kinds of skills and abilities you're going to want to have available to you when you get into the service. So one whole chapter walks through from the beginning to end, deciding ahead of time where you want to sit. Maybe that's got a quick escape route. What are you going to do if you have to take a child out? Do you want to entertain them and reward them for their inappropriate behavior, or do you want to use it as a training opportunity? Also, simple skills like teaching a child how to whisper. There's nothing quite so distracting as a young one who turns to mom and says, "Can I do that?" right out loud in the middle of something. And it's amazing to me how many parents don't stop to think about how helpful it can be in lots of different situations if a child knows how to whisper. Nonverbal communication between parent and child. Yes, we cover a lot of these things.
Yeah, the look. Is that a chapter in the book?
Yes. Not a whole chapter, but
not
it's
a whole
there.
Chapter.
Yes, I think that's a universal type thing. I've seen that a number of times. I've also spent a ton of time in the back of church with our kids, so I understand the feeling. Do a lot of the churches that you help, do they have what do they call them, like the crying rooms or something like that at the churches?
That's a half and half sort of thing. Most have something. Some of them have it set up so that there's a window so you can see what's going on. A lot of them have TV sets or audio of what's going on in the service. So there's usually an option. If not, there's a lobby or an narthex where someone can walk their child around while the need is there. So there's usually something. And we don't tell people, well, you know, that's terrible. You can't have cry rooms. You can't have nurseries, all that sort of thing. It's just this idea of the family worshiping together ought to be their goal.
Yeah, I mean, I think it extends beyond church as far as the discipline goes. Yeah. I think if the kid can keep it together for 45 minutes, an hour, without being out of hand, understanding and respecting others, I think is something that just doesn't need to be applied to church. But you know, whenever you take the kids out shopping, or if you're out to dinner or something like that, I mean, respecting others' space and their time too is very important. So I can see what you're doing and proposing being very important. So what kind of questions do parents ask you when you do the and when you are counseling them and you are trying to set something up? What are some of the most common questions you get?
One of them is the first question that Sandra asked in the book: will I ever hear a sermon again?
Yeah, it's true. They want to know if there's going to be an end to the process. I appreciate what you were saying about teaching children appropriate behavior in appropriate settings, and that is the biggest collection of questions that we get. How to do that, and so on. Being some of the things you mentioned are helpful, respecting other space and everything that applies to lots of different settings. And also in this particular one, it adds the aspect of, okay, now we're praying. This is what we need to do whenever we're praying. This, the Word of God is being read, and this is the way we respect that. Practicing it at home, being consistent, is another thread that goes throughout the book that applies to all of life and child raising. And actually, we do have a curriculum that we developed, and we were working in a church that was in the process of moving from a children's program into the having the children incorporated into the service. And so it's something we're just now making available to people that buy the book, that they can have that, and it's verbatim what to say and how to build the ability to sit quiet and listen, also how to, the kinds of questions to ask, so that on the way home from church you're talking about the pastor's sermon, no matter the age of the child. And I don't know, I guess that's it.
Okay. That's pretty cool. Can you tell folks the title of the book, and is it just available on Amazon, or is it in other places?
Well, the title is Children in Church, Nurturing Hearts of Worship. And right now, we prefer that people come to our website directly, which is childreninchurch.com.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon. You can get the Kindle from Amazon, but with the paperback, just come directly to childreninchurch.com, and we'll take care of you.
Yeah, one of my grandchildren was extremely disappointed yesterday, getting bored playing on an old iPad we have, and I was taking 10 minutes to actually relax and read on a... I have a Kindle, but it's like, it's a dinosaur one. You can only read on it, you know. And he came over because he thought he had, you know, he's going to grab a new toy for me. And he's like, what are you doing? No, I'm reading. And he's like, let me see. And I showed him, you know, it's black and white screen with just words. And he's like, oh. And, you know. So, I think in this day and age, like, most of... the children my wife and I have are older. I think these younger kids, the stimulus they need is quite a bit different. You know, when you're doing any of your services as a pastor, do you try to model them differently, given that today's youth need a little more than maybe back in the day when we used to play with sticks and stones and tin cans and stuff?
Well, yeah, I've also taught... public speaking courses, and one of the things you have to do is know your audience, know your congregation, know their age groups, and so using a little bit of their own history or non-history, their jargon, etc., is always good, without giving in to whatever is cheapest in the society, in the culture today. But there are ways that as pastor, as the preacher, you can incorporate the kids in having keywords in the sermon for some of the younger ones to count and that sort of thing.
Pretty cool. Now, when you set out to do the book, did you have to outline this? I ask this just about every author on that comes on. Did you guys have to... outline this in a big way, or because you've been doing it so often, it was more of an organic write, and you knew kind of like how you wanted to lay this out?
Yeah, it was really more organic. We'd presented to numerous congregations over the years, and so we pretty much knew the order of or importance of the material that we wanted to present, and also where the questions often arise. In the original draft, we did not have as much information about the church bag, which is one of our major strategies, and we added that in, and it's a whole chapter by itself now. So there was a, you know, adjustment from the publisher and in our follow through after we read the whole thing.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Can I follow this up with anything else?
Well, the curriculum, we're going to have 6 different units so that people can really work either in the congregation or at home. That's another big thing that's called home training, and the curriculum will fit in with that. And afterward, whatever people bring up, if there's more that we can spread out on the topic, we'll be happy to do that.
That's pretty neat. Now, when folks... pretty much worship at home and not go into a physical church. How is it that they do different things like baptisms, confessions, that kind of stuff? Do they still maintain a relationship with a physical church?
Well, the answer to that varies. You know, some people are do-it-yourself types who disdain church. You know, I can be a Christian and I don't have to be around the church. Others are just doing it because it seems right to them at the time, and there's not a church that suits them around. But they will have a relationship with a church or with pastors. For the most part, you know, for me, I believe in the sacraments, and therefore you need ordained clergy to practice those things. But not everybody agrees with that position, and I mean, it's going back to sometimes where they did the Cheetos and Pepsi for the Lord's Supper.
Okay.
But not everybody is quite that loose.
Yeah,
but it varies.
I understand sometimes it's a distant type thing where someone may live in an area that's not too highly populated. But generally, seems like there's plenty of churches around.
There are.
Yeah, which but to each his own, you know. I just find it interesting how folks maybe do that kind of thing. Okay.
Well, Kurt's been involved in a few of those settings as well, and they're actually church plants, where people don't find something in their area that a congregation in their area that meets what they see as doctrinal issues, or maybe the flavor of a church is too old-fashioned to them or whatever. And so Kurt goes out as a preaching point, and then it develops into a congregation. So it can be a group that's in that kind of process as well.
Yeah, there's got to be a desire and a want and a connection. I can see that at times, especially if maybe folks are a little more fundamental than others may care for, or some things like that. I can see that to a degree. It's a very personal thing. I think it's interesting the choices some folks make. So.
It is. In a lot of times when we work with parents, they're the ones that become challenged, not just in their parenting, but in their own worship. Do they even know what some of the symbols are in the sanctuary when they're sitting with their children to be able to explain what is this piece for and what does that represent? Or when the service is taking place and it's maybe communion. You know, what is it all about? You need to be prepared to discuss those things with your children. And when you're talking about worship, what does that mean in their own lives as adults, as parents, so that they can model that and talk to their children about it and so on. It's really a bigger thing than just making sure kids are quiet. That's why the subtitle, Nurturing Hearts of Worship, you know, parents and children, what are we talking about when we talk about worship?
Yeah, it's not just a 45 minutes you're in church. So,
exactly right.
Yeah, a lot of people miss out on that, you know, especially when church is over and everybody's running out to the parking lot to get in their car and hit everybody on the way out. It gets to be a little lost at times, you know. So it's for me, there's a local there's a small diner down the road from church, and it's pretty well attended, and if the pastor talks too long in the morning at the early mass, a lot of the older folks will bug out after communion because they don't want to miss their seat at the diner. So, it's always interesting watching them skedaddle. And it just makes me chuckle, you know, because they don't want to sit at another spot in the diner. They have their spot. But that affords
they have their own pew.
Yeah.
They have their own pew in the sanctuary.
That's the Christmas Easter type thing, you know. And I can't tell you how many times I've sat in a choir loft and I'm thinking, well, number one, I don't mind it up in a choir loft too much. Number two, it's like one of my kids will be like, hey, don't we usually sit down here in that row right there? Who's at my seat? And it's like, you know, hey, you know, they're here. Just be thankful they're here, you know? So I'm more than happy to sit up in the choir loft so somebody else can have my seat that doesn't, you know, maybe not come, maybe come every week. That's fine. But yeah, I can respect all that. I don't know how you guys handle it day in and day out, because I think that's got to be a rough road to hoe. But, you know, if that's your vocation, I can respect that. As we're winding down time here, what's a question maybe either I haven't asked you today you're hoping I would, or maybe a question in your travels that someone hasn't asked you yet that you were always hoping they would?
Well, part of it would be, how do we deal with the people who are resistant?
Yeah.
And it needs to be done in a winsome way. Both sides of the equation where there is resistance need to work on it. The parents need to be respectful of the other people who don't have children in the congregation with them. And in the book, in the last chapter, it's called Note to Church Leaders. And it's exactly that. It's, dear church leaders, don't see this as a challenge to your leadership or anything like that. In fact, it's an opportunity. But you need to get the sides working together. The people who aren't accustomed to hearing kids in the worship service need to give a little. And the parents who are bringing their children in who aren't quite accustomed to this, they need to be respectful and deal with the children appropriately. So that's one of the big things.
I think for me, I would really enjoy it if some of the congregants would ask, how can we, as fellow attendees and members of the church, how can we support these families? And I would talk to them about offering to sit with one of the older children if an infant needs to be taken out, or as I did for some of the time, our organist had a two-year-old with her, and while she was playing, I would slide over and sit with the two-year-old. Sometimes, well, it's great to just offer a welcoming hand, encourage them to be there, and then get to know them enough that you can make that kind of an offer, something that's practical, or ask them, what can I do to help you? That's the question I would like to be asked.
Nice. Very nice. Well, I want to thank you for being on today. It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate
Our
it.
Our pleasure, too.
Awesome.
Thank you.
In the broadcast,
I feel like we could...
I'm sorry, please.
Go
ahead.
I appreciate it, too. I'm sure that we could talk for a long time.
Oh, good. That sounds fine. We'll save that for the next time. I appreciate you coming out there. Everybody, Kurt and Sandra Lovelace, go to their website or Amazon for their book. Earlier in the broadcast, we had George Taylor and Sue Badeau. And I want to thank everybody for listening. And I want to thank all the folks on Facebook and Twitter and StumbleUpon and Pinterest and Tumblr and all the other places we're on social media. Thank you so much for helping folks find a new author to them. I hope everybody has an awesome weekend. We'll see you next week. Have a great day, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.